Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, October 7th, 2003, and coming to you live from WGMU and George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict.
Good morning, Dr. Tom. My name is Van Tao. I will discuss and learnings about the avatoxic with you to help me and some other Hmong and Hmong community understanding about avatoxic throughout the United States. First, I will ask you a question. What is the pathology? Pathology of that gene?
Wo Chao Vang, and Na Zhang. Pathology is the study of disease using medical science.
Dr. Tong, they are the pathology, yeah. Go, choose your job, come on.
A pathologist is a medical doctor trained in the study of disease who examines body tissue removed at surgery, examines the dead body at autopsy, and examines body fluids such as blood and urine in a laboratory.
Choose your day, Guan Cha, Holu Jie, Tia Ji Ho.
Did you get much feedback after the program from your listeners?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We, you know, of course, the show is very short. It's only an hour show. But we did have a number of people call in, and we actually had to do two shows because the first one was the actual presentation of the information wasn't enough to carry the call in, so we had to schedule another show afterward to specifically just to answer the individual questions. Obviously, there are a lot of misunderstandings, and like Dr. Russ and I were discussing, you know, a lot of people were saying that parts of a person's body organs were taken out and being sold on the black market or things like that, which isn't true. And people are still saying that, believing that it might be happening. And he, you know, had to come on the show to explain that that's not the case at all. In fact, it was everything, you know, how explain the procedure and how it was put back, and eventually just, you know, get everything clarified.
So it sounds like there was really a sense of relief from a lot of listeners after that.
Yes, he and I, including Dr. Tom Ress and my co-host, were able to, you know, instill a lot of that information into the community.
And welcome to Conflict. I'm Sean Dunning. Every week, we explore a new topic associated with innovative, non-adversarial, and collaborative means by which people all over are effectively finding solutions to the inevitable conflicts that we face in life. Today, we take a look at solutions to cultural conflict associated with Western medicine. Specifically, we will hear about some efforts in Northern California to help create mutual understanding around issues dealing with forensic autopsies in the immigrant Hmong community. The segment you just heard was from a radio program that medical examiner Dr. Tom Resk participated in on a Hmong language radio show in Chico, California. We'll hear from Dr. Resk later on to learn more about what motivated him to take such a step. Later on the program, we'll be joined in the studio by Dr. Linda Johnston of the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution right here at George Mason University. She's an expert in conflict in the public health field as well as worldview theory, race, and ethnicity. To start off the program, we now go to the interview with Dr. Tom Resk. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to make, please send them to questions@conflictradio.org or comments@conflictradio.org. The following interview lasts approximately 25 minutes.
I live and work in Northern California above Sacramento, which is in the pretty far north of California, in a county, rural county called Butte County, and I'm the forensic pathologist for that county. And a Hmong family had objected to an autopsy that was done under the coroner's jurisdiction, and this was some weeks after an autopsy was done, and we ended up having a meeting with that family to discuss their concerns about an autopsy having been done on an elderly member, 66-year-old member of the Hmong family. I was approached by the funeral home at which I did the autopsy, and he had been approached by the Hmong family, and the suggestion was made that we have a meeting. It was basically to address their concerns of why an autopsy had been done, in hopes to avoid having any autopsies done on any other elderly members of their family. They didn't understand why an autopsy was necessary in this elderly member of their family. So consequently, myself, together with the chief deputy coroner of the county that in which the autopsy was done, and the mortician and several members of the Hmong family, including a non-English-speaking elder of the family, as well as two relatives of the deceased lady, came to the funeral home, and we met and discussed her issues for about an hour, hour and a half or so, and were able to resolve their concerns and address the reasons why an autopsy was necessary in their specific family member, and why in general autopsies, coroner autopsies or medical examiner autopsies are done in general, and especially on older members of the population that may indeed have some disease process, but it may not be current information about that disease process, and may be insufficient to establish a cause of death, and there may be some other issues that pertain as well to the reason that an autopsy might be done under a medical examiner or a coroner's jurisdiction.
So, notwithstanding the reasons why, under the law and otherwise, that an autopsy needed to be done, what type of objections or concerns did the Hmong community, or in particular this family, have with the fact that an autopsy had been done?
Well, within the United States, there are about 300,000 Hmong. Well, the vast majority of those Hmong have animistic beliefs and utilize shamans for cultural rituals and healing rituals. They basically serve as the doctors of the community, the priests of the community, from a Western sense. Although there are a small number of Hmong, there are probably less than 10% of the Hmong in the United States are Christian, and would reflect values that Western culture in America is more familiar with from a Judeo-Christian ethic. And having animistic beliefs, they believe in spirits of the forest, for example, good spirits, evil spirits. They also believe in reincarnation, and that after death, it's critically important for the body to not be tampered with, so that the body during the reincarnation, so that the body can enter the spirit world and be accepted by their ancestors that have died before them, and be in a whole, complete sense, physical complete sense. So there's a fear that an autopsy will disrupt that normal flow of rituals and may make the body, the deceased person that they have had an autopsy done to them, unacceptable in the spirit world to the ancestors, and also may make that dead person to whom the surviving relatives, family members, have a profound family obligation and cultural obligation, it may make those surviving family members vulnerable to the return of the spirit of the dead person to basically haunt them. That is, why did you let that happen to me? You shouldn't have done that. And in fact, a kind of a form of post-traumatic stress.
Is that in part what may have motivated the family to seek answers even after the autopsy had been done and their family member buried, I presume?
Indeed, that was in part of their concern, but also part of their concern, a main part of their concern, was they did not understand why it was necessary to perform an autopsy. And this 66-year-old lady who had had a history of having had a stroke a couple of years before she died, and there was a fear among many of the family members and other clan members that basically the horse was out of the barn now, and now all of the members of the family might be subject to an autopsy if this, in their feeling, person that was should have been painfully obvious not to have had an autopsy done on, that an autopsy, in fact, was done on that. That there was the feeling, I believe, although it wasn't stated, that perhaps, in a Western sense, that the autopsy may have been arbitrary and even capricious and done for no real valid reason, and that was a major concern as well. But it was really more a subcontext rather than the context of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So when you held this first meeting, it sounds like there were a lot of concerns up front. Of those concerns, what was alleviated, or what do you feel that meeting accomplished in terms of generating mutual understanding?
Well, actually, two things, Sean. There were some feelings that were addressed up front, but really what I was able to do is I was able to respond to their directly expressed concerns, of course, but then also having done a little research into it, and realizing that there were some other issues that they may have been, in fact, too polite to bring up. For example, the concern and the fear among a number of Hmong people that, in fact, during an autopsy, organs are taken or stolen, in fact, by a person such as myself, a forensic pathologist, and then might be given away or sold for organ donor purposes. So there's definitely a patent fear for that. Or that organs are kept by the pathologist and not returned to the body, which would be a big objection. As well as whether or not metal objects, scalpel blades, for example, might be left in the body, which would make the body unacceptable to the spirit world. And I think probably the bottom line is that they were able to come away with an understanding and appreciation of why specifically their 66-year-old family member, why it was necessary to do an autopsy on that person. And basically the short answer to that was that there was an insufficient current history or medical records to support a reasonable cause of death in that lady. She had not been attended by a physician in some time, although she did indeed have a history of having had a stroke 2 years before. But there was just insufficient medical records to sign the case out, and indeed her family physician said he didn't have a clue why she died and didn't really expect her to die. So that's what led to, in fact, the autopsy on her. But beyond that, I think they came away with a wider understanding and broader appreciation of the role of the forensic autopsy in Western culture. And I know that particular meeting was able to satisfy some of the fears that were not directly expressed, but I know existed because of various members of the Hmong community I'd had a chance to talk to before having this meeting with this Hmong family. And some of those regard racism, are the Hmong specifically singled out to have autopsies done on, as if that was something that the forensic pathologists really had any choice in. And of course, the clarification was able to be provided on all of those matters. And then we also discussed, well, what can we do? We have in our particular county, relatively a smaller rural county in Northern California with a population of about 250,000 people. We have a relatively small population of Hmong, probably about 5,000 people. And we said, well, what can we do from a coroner's standpoint to address this issue when further deaths occur in the Hmong community? And that's where we had some very significant success. And because there are 18 clans within the Hmong culture, not every solution, there's not necessarily one solution for all 18 clans, which is not surprising. And they readily admitted that. But what we worked out for at least this particular clan and this particular family within our county, that is the coroner's office, would, if we knew that the decedent was a member of the Hmong community, within the limits of the law, we could do some specific things that would provide for cultural sensitivity to their cultural needs. And that was to delay the autopsy for a day or so, if at all possible. And usually we can do that. Sometimes we can't, but usually we can do that. Second, we would also approach the family and contact the Hmong family and let them know that they would have the option, if they so elected, to go into the funeral home and where the body would be kept and in the presence of a basically a deputized coroner could address the dead body because they feel that the spirit of the dead body persists in the dead body even after death for a period of some time. And that they could address the dead body and say, an autopsy will have to be done. We know this is terrible, but it must be done by the laws of the United States. And it's not our fault, in kind of with a subtextual message that, or in other words, don't hold us responsible. That is your surviving family members. It's not our responsibility. And that was agreed to. And then another thing that has since been worked out, because it just makes eminent sense because of additional deaths that indeed have occurred, as one would anticipate within any community, certainly the Hmong community as well, that we would develop a liaison, or actually a series of people within the Hmong culture that were familiar with the Hmong culture and were also native speakers, so that they could address some of these concerns and basically act as a liaison or intermediary between the coroner's office, the needs of the law, and the cultural desires and needs of the usually first-generation Hmong family member that's died. So we've been able to do that, and so far it's only been in several months, but we've actually been quite successful in setting up the infrastructure that will accommodate those developments.
Wow. I must say I'm struck by the amount of cultural sensitivity that's being shown by you and those whom you're collaborating with. What do you think could be learned from your experience specifically dealing with forensic pathology, and how could that be perhaps how could that improve the situation with the medical community at large?
Well, of course, knowledge is power, and for both sides, both for, you know, Western forensic pathology sides and for the Hmong community leaders and Hmong family members. And the more dialogue that occurs, the more fruitful discussions and solutions that can be reached and accommodations when that's possible. And hopefully for doctors from trained in Western medicine to be more culturally aware that there are quite substantial differences in belief from among their sets of various sets of patients that they deal with, and reflecting my own bias of being a Western trained physician, there's a certain arrogance, probably cultural arrogance or scientific arrogance that we probably project, certainly to our American patients, to the chagrin of many of our own doctors, that, well, I'm the doctor and I know best. And to members, for example, of the Hmong community and other communities as well, that doesn't necessarily fly. And a Western doctor for a person straight from Laos is essentially totally unknown and is not equivalent, because they have the only equivalent they have is probably a shaman back in the mountains of Laos, and a shaman carries much more weight and credibility with the members of the Hmong community than in fact do Western trained European or American doctors, much to the chagrin of doctors, I'm sure, or to the chagrin of some doctors, and probably to the fascination of other doctors. So to the extent that Western medicine can attempt to understand that and utilize some of the best that the West has to offer and try to integrate that with long cultural patterns, for example, using shamans in a combined healing process, where perhaps the Western physician can use conventional methods requiring medication and or surgery, and let the shaman do their role in doing things. It certainly provides a lot of psychological comfort for members of the Hmong community to have their beliefs acknowledged and honored, and at the same time allowing Western medicine to work their magic, so to speak.
Well, those are obviously some great recommendations in terms of what could be done with practice. But just to back up a little bit, you mentioned the need for dialogue, and I understand you've taken some initiative on your own to create just a little bit more dialogue about these issues in your community. I understand you did a radio program recently?
I did. I actually do a radio show, classical music show, with a friend of mine, and on a community public radio station here in Northern California, and it coincidentally, there happens to be three different Hmong shows, radio shows, that are done on this particular community public radio station here in Northern California. And one of them is focused towards more of an adult set rather than a teenage set, with news and information. And I had approached those individuals that I knew from this radio station, KZFR, and had inquired would they have any interest in doing some sort of a segment or a portion of a show on forensic autopsy in the Hmong community. And they essentially said, boy, would we ever. And we ended up scripting a radio show, which was an elaborate affair, because there are no words for some very common English terms, for example, internal organs of the body, uterus, MRI scan. There are no MRI scanners in Laos. I mean, there are no hospitals in Laos where these folks, you know, originally come from. So, and in fact, you have to admire a culture that has difficulty in translating the word homicide, and yet they were having some difficulty doing that. To give you an example, you know, I'm a forensic pathologist, but the way I was it was translated, my function was, I believe I was described as something like a person who cuts up bodies after they're dead. So with the help of a number of individuals, both in this county, Hmong members of the community, both in this county and other counties, Merced County, we crafted this hour-long radio show that aired in the middle of July this year. And with a combination of English and Hmong script, and it was there was a tremendous amount of interest in our county, with an estimated 80% of the total Hmong population listening to that particular show. And that was at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning, 6 to 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning, like 4,000 Hmong listened to that.
Now, from these conversations and dialogues that you've had so far, are there still any outstanding concerns that have not been addressed, or is there anything that at this point seems irreconcilable in terms of the needs to do autopsies and the manners by which they're done?
No, nothing that has seemed irreconcilable at all to me. I think we've been able to successfully address all issues that were raised by them, and then a number of other additional issues that were not specifically raised by them, at least initially, but then there was kind of a pleasant sigh of relief when they were informed that there was that organs were not taken for donation, and there's kind of a certain fear. There's a number of rumors that had been going around among members of the Hmong community. So I'm sure there are always additional issues that may come up at some point, but at least initially, it seems like we've cleaned the slate of the concerns that were out there. And one area of concern that I initially had, because it was clear in the initial meeting that we had with this first initial Klan member, they made it clear that there certainly is divided opinion, or there may be differences of opinion between various clans, that what worked for this one clan, specifically in Butte County, that might mitigate some of the cultural negatives of doing an autopsy on a family member, may not equate or work for other clients as well. And at least when that was subsequently raised by me some 5 or 6 months later in this latest meeting that I had with all of the clan leaders at this United Hmong community, I actually specifically asked that. Does anybody have any objections to that, or would they like to see something else as an alternative when an autopsy has to be done? Because there are times when, indeed, an autopsy has to be done. And no one voiced any concern that, no, we would prefer something else be done or anything like that. So it looks like we're headed in the right direction. We'll probably have to make some changes here and there and some fine-tuning, but I think we've gotten off on a good foot, and there's been a good basis of understanding and continued dialogue, and we have a number of avenues and basically have established some very positive connections and a network of individuals to whom we can turn, and indeed to whom the leaders of the Hmong community can turn if and when some subsequent issue arises that may lie within the purview of the medical examiner coroner system here in Northern California.
Well, congratulations on all your efforts. They sure seem to be paying off.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your efforts at making this this information available. I think, although it's fairly specific to the Hmong community, I think it's applicable in many different areas, cross-cultural sensitivity, whether in this case it's the Hmong community, but in other cases it could be Native Americans or Australian Aboriginal groups or Pacific Islanders or Inuit. There are any number of cross-cultural issues that can come up with respect either to Western medical traditions or other communication problems, basically fundamental communication problems. And I think that's fundamentally is what we're looking at is an issue of communication and cultural sensitivity, and I think we've been able to successfully address those.
Well, Dr. Esk, thank you for your time. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for sharing your story.
Well, and good luck to you, Sean, and thanks for bringing this out and pointing out the levels of multiple levels that the story basically addresses in terms of communication and Hmong culture and anthropological issues and things. And best luck to you, Sean.
And good afternoon. You're listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. We just heard an interview with Dr. Tom Resk, who's a medical examiner, forensic pathologist out in Northern California, and we just heard his about some of his efforts to establish some mutual understanding between the immigrant Hmong community and the medical community, specifically the medical examiner's office dealing with autopsies and issues surrounding that. We're going to take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Dr. Linda Johnston.
Lord, I do know.
welcome back to Conflict on WGMU Radio, coming to you live from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, on 650 AM and webcasted on WGMUradio.com. Well, every week on Conflict, we look for examples of efforts to address conflict that embrace non-adversarial, collaborative approaches. And today we are examining the challenge of seeking solutions for cultural conflict associated with Western medicine. We just heard from Dr. Tom Resk, who is a medical examiner and forensic pathologist in Northern California. He shared with us his efforts to create mutual understanding between the medical examiner's office and the immigrant Hmong community regarding issues dealing with forensic autopsies. Now it's time to hear from our studio guest, Dr. Linda Johnston. Dr. Johnston has a PhD in conflict analysis and resolution and is a professor at George Mason University's Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. Her interests surround health-related concerns, worldview theory, race and ethnicity, and narrative and discourse theory. Dr. Johnston comes to conflict studies with 20 years of experience in the public health field, where she has served as project director, consultant, and supervisor of several public health programs ranging from teen pregnancy clinics to senior citizen nutrition programs. She is also a trained mediator and facilitator. Dr. Johnston, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me here.
It's a pleasure to have you, and very interested to get your kind of response from that interview with Dr. Resk. What did you think about that?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. He really did focus on a lot of the concerns that come up in cross-cultural medical care. And I especially liked what he said about getting the best of both cultures in on making any medical decision.
Mm-hmm. What did you think in particular about the effort to have a radio show? It sounds like they had 4,000 people listening to that, 4,000 people from the Hmong community. Again, that's typically a Hmong language show, so you're not going to have other folks listening to it.
Right. That is probably not surprising in terms of the interest that something like this draws from a particular cultural community. We've had the same experience when I was working in North Carolina with the Montagnards, and word spreads very quickly in the community when something like this happens and a mm-hmm. medical issue gets raised. So the 4,000 people listening doesn't really surprise me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, at one point I asked Dr. Resk if there were any outstanding issues that the show had not addressed, and he seemed to indicate that, from his perspective, from the feedback they got on the program, that a lot of those concerns that the Hmong community had regarding autopsies had, in fact, been alleviated. Do you think that's maybe too optimistic?
No, I don't think so. I think what he has done is he's opened a dialogue, which is, of course, necessary in any situation like this. And he has opened it up for other questions to come in later. It may not have alleviated all the questions regarding medical care, but at least he started a dialogue. So when another question comes up, they have a contact person to go to have the questions mm-hmm. answered.
And, in fact, that interview was rather edited down. I spoke with him at great length, about an hour and a half. And, you know, he mentioned some other activities he's involved with now from this. It's just been kind of snowballing. Mm-hmm. And he's now been called upon by the elders in the different clans in the Hmong community there in Butte County to actually address clan leaders at meetings. And, mm-hmm. and they just seem to be really taking hold of his volunteerism to really give an honest, balanced description of what forensic autopsies are really all about. And so it wasn't just the radio program and that initial meeting we heard about, but in fact he's actually working, seems to be getting called left and right to all kinds of places. I'm not sure if he intended that from the beginning, but he's certainly making a reputation for himself out there.
Yeah, I think that's very important that that a community has someone that they can go to for those kinds of things. I think he also brought up something that was very important in terms of people not just translating the language, but being able to serve as boundary spanners mm-hmm. between the two communities and to translate the culture. I had to chuckle when he was talking about the fact that the very name pathology gets translated
a person who cuts people up
after they're dead.
Imagine.
That kind of a image has to be culturally translated, and it's really important to have someone in the community who can do those kinds of cultural translations, not just translate the language word for word.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do you think about you know, this approach to dealing with other types of cultural conflict as it deals with medicine?
I think it's really important like he said, to bring the best of both cultures into any situation. I think where the medical community in this country is cautious is around issues of ethics and legality. And where the other communities, in my experience, have coming into the U.S. have had concerns, it's been around racism or around their spiritual beliefs or their distrust of the medical community. And I think all it takes is for groups to sit down together and to talk very honestly about what those concerns are.
Mm-hmm. What, do you have any examples of situations like that that you've dealt with?
Yes. My first real encounter with this was with the Montagnards when they came from Vietnam. And I can remember coming into clinic one night and all of us working all night because we had a whole plane full of people that had come in and we were processing paperwork and that kind of thing all through the night. And one of the things that came up was we had a very, very sick baby that came. And the mother was extremely fearful of all these people in the white jackets and all the stethoscopes and all of these kinds of things, which, of course, she had never seen before. And she was asking the translator, who were these people and what were they going to be doing to her baby? Because it was obvious, I think, to her that we were all concerned about her baby, which obviously was suffering from kwashiorkor and masmerus. And it was really interesting that she was listening to the translator talk about all of the degrees that these people had and all of their medical training and all of that. And she listened for about 10 minutes to this, and then she said, who among this group of people has children and understands me? And none of them except me had children. And so she said to them, well, then none of you are qualified to tell me what to do with my child. And, of course, I was kind of on the low end of the totem pole in terms of degrees and experience in this particular situation, and yet she was trusting me because I had children. Therefore, I knew what to do. And I respect my coworkers in that sense because they stepped back from that. And they essentially talked through me to tell the woman what needed to be done. And so we finally got the baby hospitalized and we were able to resolve the situation. And the mother went to the hospital with the baby and she was able to stay right there with the baby. And the translator went with her also. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one example where we went with her belief system, but we also got what we needed for her and for the baby.
Right. And, you know, Dr. Resk talked about almost an inherent arrogance that comes along with a lot of folks with many initials after their name in the medical community. And, it, you know, certainly it's not that they have negative intentions. Their intentions are quite noble from their perspective, but it's a matter of having that cultural sensitivity to realize the need to connect not just through communication, but you know, like you say, to have that cultural liaison who can really, and in your situation, the common ground there was having children, and that's what bought you credibility there. And for instance, with the Hmong examples, Dr. Resk was talking about the shaman, you know, would be the credible figure for them when it comes to dealing with pain and medical issues. Mm-hmm. And so, in any case, what do you think we can take from that? Now, again, out in California, they were dealing with autopsies, and after the fact, after someone had already died, they still had serious concerns about how that person was you know, taken care of, and a lot of it, to me, just seems like rumors. You know, their concerns, their fears were just based on a lot of rumors. Now, from your perspective, Dr. Johnson, is it really as simple as just dispelling those rumors and having that conversation?
I think there is probably a basic distrust simply because they're not familiar. In the case of the Montagnards that I just spoke about, they were just not familiar with Western medicine. And I think then part of it is just explaining it, just having a thorough explanation of what was going to happen and to not surprise anyone with it. But I think there are some clarifications that need to happen in terms of what has to be done and what can be put aside in terms of Western medicine. Not everything has to be done right away if you're dealing with someone who's fearful. I can remember at one point in this interview with the Montagnard woman, she was very tearful and obviously worried about her baby and what was going to happen with the baby. And she turned to the translator and she translated to me, "If this were your baby, would you do what they're telling me to do?" And I said, yes, I would. And she translated back to the translator that, okay, well, then if she would do this for her baby, mm-hmm. then I will do it with my baby.
It's just down-to-earth human reassurance.
Mother to mother. It mm-hmm. got down to, you know, I have 10 health initials after my name. It got down to throwing those away and just saying, uh-huh. you know, mother to mother, would you do this? I would do this if you would do this.
Well, you know, that's what I find so compelling about, again, Dr. Resk's efforts out there. He's doing this really as a citizen of the community, and he does represent the medical examiner's office. But he comes across, you know, off the air, you know, when we were talking about his initial meetings, you know, he had thought about, well, should I wear a tie and dress up? And he ended up just going really casual and just mm-hmm. trying to, you know, he read up as much as he could on the culture and really exhibited as much sensitivity as one can imagine. And it seemed to really score points, if you will. And particularly what I found interesting, though, is suggestion, and you mentioned this as well, to really look through both cultural perspectives. It's not just about one crossing over to the other side, but, you know, how can we find collaborative ways to deal with these conflicts as they arise? And so, for instance, it sounds like with the Butte County Medical Examiner's Office, they have an initiative now that allows for some flexibility in how the autopsy process is executed. You know, they'll allow for the family members to actually go into the funeral home and kind of speak to their past family member. And that's something that, you know, I guess many doctors would just kind of maybe laugh at or just not really understand or just say, hey, you know, the law doesn't permit that. Do you have any other suggestions or examples of where kind of Western medicine practices have been integrated with other perspectives?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you bring up a really interesting point about where does the legality and the ethics start and stop. Mm-hmm. And I think, first of all, that as long as we don't run into legal problems, I find most health professionals very willing to mm-hmm. cross those cultural lines, as long as there's not some sort of a legal or ethical issue that gets crossed. I find the people that I have worked with to be very, very flexible. And I think I'd like to point out, too, that it's not just in us dealing with another culture. It's also cultural, the differences in cultural beliefs even within this country.
Sure, yeah.
And people are not all the same with that, and people have different views of what health and disease are. And, for example, our focus in this country on health and fitness varies very much, mm-hmm. even between cultures in this country. You know, people from nations that are starving nations, for example, would think that our focus on health and fitness is kind of ridiculous. Why don't you conserve those calories, you know, where we think about burning them off?
Right.
But just talking about what those kinds of things mean to different cultures, I think, is very important.
Do you have any other stories you'd like to share along those lines?
I think one other one that I came across when I was dealing with research, we had a Hispanic population that we were dealing with, and in our interview questions, we used the word pediatrician, and we had mm-hmm. it perfectly translated into Spanish, and we said that we were asking mothers if they took their child to a pediatrician, and the answer on the survey kept coming up resoundingly no. And yet we knew from our own experience that, you know, women took their babies to a pediatrician. But it was just in the translation of the word. They would have answered yes had we said, do you take your baby to a doctor? But in this community, taking your baby to a pediatrician was considered haughty. Huh. And so they were saying, no, we wouldn't do that because it would appear haughty in that community to take your child to a specialist.
Interesting.
But we would, you know, if we would have just said doctor, we would have gotten almost 100% yes on the questionnaire. It was our misunderstanding of the use of the language in that community.
You know, recently I read a book by Anne Fadiman called The Spirit Catches You and Then You Fall Down. And again, it's about the Hmong example, and it tells a story of a little girl in Merced, California, who had epilepsy. And as you know, that requires a lot of medical attention throughout one's life. And the Hmong, you know, family of this little girl just kept running into roadblocks within the, you know, they would visit the same hospital and all the doctors got to know them really well. But it seemed, at least from reading this book, that the doctors just never really, I was just beating my head against the wall reading it because I thought, well, why don't they just try to seek that understanding? But I guess it might seem common sense to one and not another. I mean, what do you think we can do within the public health field to institutionalize this type of cultural sensitivity a little more? Mm-hmm. Or do you feel that's already being done?
I feel it's already being done. I think that a lot of happened especially in the last 10 years in terms of cultural understanding, and the medical community is built on procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, expertise and scientific rigor and procedures. And everything is, and that's why we have advanced medically so as far as we have. But those procedures don't have to be done in a certain way, in a certain time frame. We can slow some of that down in order to explain to people what needs to be done. And within the realm of ethics, you know, we are responsible for doing that also, I think, to match with other people's belief systems and their customs. And I see people doing that already. I've seen a real change in the last 10 years with the medical community being much more cross-culturally sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Do you have any advice for people who are passionate about this and want to affect changes?
Mm-hmm. I think the legalities is an interesting question, mm-hmm. because with medical malpractice and all of those kinds of things, those things have to be protected, and they're there for a reason. So mm-hmm. it's a very delicate balance in terms of that, but there certainly are patient rights advocacy groups that are very, very active, and I think probably the best thing for someone interested in this is to get involved in one of those advocacy groups.
Mm-hmm.
Either for a particular culture or just patient advocacy in general for legislation.
Great. Well, and if anyone has any questions about that, you can just email me right here at conflictradio.org, questions@conflictradio.org, and I'll make sure to channel those questions appropriately. As well, we have a website, www.conflictradio.org. And later this week, we'll have this program posted up there so you can listen to it again, as well as any relevant links associated with the topics of the program today. Well, we're just about out of time today. Was there anything else you wanted to share, Dr. Johnston?
Oh, just one thing about, I mentioned the differences in not just in between the U.S. and other cultures coming into the U.S., but the differences that we need to recognize within the U.S. and how different groups would prefer to have medical treatment done. And I think that's another area where we have a lot of exploration to do.
And if one of our listeners, any of our listeners are out there, you know, find that they are in a position where they're not understood, or they're a particular member of a cultural group that is not acknowledged, you know, in the medical community, again, what kind of advice do you have for how they could approach their doctor with these types of concerns?
Well, most hospitals and public health settings have an ombudsman-type program now, which is one method of resolving conflicts within the medical community. And another, as you mentioned, is to seek out an advocacy group.
Great. Well, again, Dr. Johnston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, folks. If you have any questions or comments regarding today's program, send an email to questions@conflictradio.org or comments@conflictradio.org. And if you have any suggestions or ideas for future programs, please let us know by writing to ideas@conflictradio.org. Next week, tune in to Conflict on Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m. to hear about the upcoming Common Ground Film Festival. We'll hear from studio guest Susan Costas, who is Vice President for Arts and Culture at Search for Common Ground and the director of the third annual Common Ground Film Festival, which begins on October 21st in Washington, D.C. We'll hear from Susan as well as some of the directors from the films to be featured. One more announcement to make. I wanted to credit the clip earlier at the very beginning of the program that we showed, that we aired from the radio program out in Northern California, and that was provided care of KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, California, from the program The Hmong Voice, hosted by Kirk Lee and Sang Yang. That was aired on July 20th, 2003. Well, until next week, I'm Sean Dunning. Thanks for listening.